Profile interview.
Just received a message coming from somebody who doesn't give us their names. Is you only read messages from your friends and those whom you fear. Suppose that means that you are my friend and I fear you too.
Yeah.
Oh, you gotta love this job. Judge Dennis Davis is my guest, host of Judge for Yourself on ENCA and many, many other current affairs shows. If you have been watching current affairs shows in South Africa, you'd be aware of that. But also an accomplished, seasoned, man of the law, man who has been a teacher of the law in many, many parts of the world, respected all over the world. And he has done me one of the greatest honors to agree to come and do this conversation with me. Judge Davis, thank you so much for joining us. I really, really appreciate your time.
Pleasure, Aubrey, and hope you're well.
So, I mean, so much happening in this country at the moment. I remember hearing you once, many, many, many years ago. I think the show was still, I think it was Judge for Yourself at the time. Was it Judge for, not Judge for Yourself?
I think the first one was Future Imperfect.
Future Imperfect, that's the one. That's where you said there is no place like South Africa. And at that moment, I suppose we were still looking towards the elections of 1994, I think it was. And you said that's right. South Africa is probably the most exciting place to be. Do you still feel the same way, Judge?
Well, I think if you're South African, always like a roller coaster. You know, you sort of Mondays and Wednesdays, you're very excited, and the rest of the week, you're depressed. You know, but it's still a place which is full of life, if I can put it this way. I mean, we are facing an election, and it's not for me, of course, to get into the party politics, but it is an election which seems to me to be as important to the future of the country as 1994 was.
Yeah. Judge, where did the bug of law bite you? I mean, you've been with the law in many, many different ways. You've been an attorney yourself. You've been a judge. You've contributed to conversations about the law, the constitution in this country, asked many deep, sagacious questions about that. Where did this law thing come from with you?
Well, it's a strange thing you ask. It came because my mom was a legal secretary, worked for a law firm. And when I was a small child, I used to go there to have my lunch on my way home from school, because so my mother was making sure that I get a decent meal instead of being on my own at home. And I used to go to the law firm. And from very early on, it seemed to me, you know, this seemed to be the sort of area that interested me and that got, you know, more and more this case. I also think that people of my generation, kids, listened to a program called Consider Your Verdict, which was a half-an-hour radio program which distilled famous criminal trials, whether it be in South Africa or I think mainly in England. And so, you know, the real drama of law was presented on the radio. In those days, you may remember, there was no television. And so I got totally captivated both by my mother's experience and by this weekly radio program, which was the favorite of a number of us, all of whom, oddly enough, did go into law.
Yeah. And you think that it was inspired by just listening to these programs where, you know, legal principles were being discussed?
Yeah, it seemed to me that, you know, it was an exciting thing to be involved in. And I suppose from an early stage, one, you know, in a very incoherent way, if I could put it that way, one began, you know, one was living in an apartheid society which seemed to be so profoundly unjust, even though one was privileged. And I'll give you an example of what I mean. So I went to a Jewish school, which obviously talked quite a lot about the Holocaust. And there's a very famous photograph of the little boy having his hands up, and behind him two enormous Gestapo officers with their guns pointed at him.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely frightening. And that day, when I left the school, I went to have my lunch at my mother's legal office. which was at the top of Adley Street and was used to be called the Volkskasse building.
Yeah.
And in those days, of course, there was dreadful enforcement of the pass laws. And as I walked as a kid of probably 10 along Adley Street, these enormous policemen were chasing small children, black children, clearly essentially trying to enforce the pass laws. And it appeared to me to be so similar to what I'd just seen at the school that I felt somewhere in a very kind of childish way, when I grow up, I've got to stop this somehow. And it seemed to me that law was the way you did that. And it sort of grew on me from that very early age.
Do you sometimes look at what's going on in Gaza and feel the same?
Of course I do. Of course I do. It's a dreadful situation.
I've been having...
Go ahead. No. I was just going to say, you know, if you believe in a cosmopolitan view of the world, the death of any child, the rape of any woman of any kind, it should be a tragedy. And so to live in a world where this is happening at the moment is just agonizingly awful. And of course I feel that way, yes.
Yeah. We've been having a number of conversations, and as you can imagine, conversations that can be very polarizing. Because the one thing about South Africa, as you know, we are a robust, loud democracy. We're loud and we differ, and that's great. There's nothing wrong with that. One of the questions that I raised in one of the conversations I had in the past was, and this was before the 7th of October last year, I raised the question that said, is it possible for those who were oppressed to become the oppressors? And it was a conversation that, again, was emotive, was divisive, because a lot of people were suggesting that, or thinking that I'm suggesting that black people can be oppressive to people that that oppressed them in the past. And I was saying, I'm asking, is it a possibility that those that were oppressed at one point, deeply oppressed, can change and become the oppressors of others with even greater fervor than the previous oppressors? I'm holding the opinion that it is possible, but I'm interested to hear your thoughts about that.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, there's a lot of psychological evidence, of course, that people who brutalized as children essentially turn out to be brutalizers themselves. Not everyone, of course. And as a judge, I've always been amazed by the fact that you can have two people coming from the same family, one who's a terrible criminal and the other is doing most extraordinary things in the community. So you can't automatically say that's the case. But there's no doubt that a brutalized background has significant psychological effects. And I would think that, of course, it's possible, because if we just can move away from identity for one second and just look at humanity, the truth about it is that human beings are capable of the most extraordinarily generous acts on the one hand and terrible evil acts on the other. And I think sometimes what you're talking about are people who've not learned the lessons of history, that because they've been brutalized, you would say that they should actually ensure not this will never happen again on my watch to anybody, notwithstanding what happened to me.
Yeah.
But I'm afraid that we're imperfect as human beings, and we allow that to occur. But it's perfectly fine, it seems to me, to debate this and to call it out wherever it takes place.
Yeah.
Because we should be arguing in favor of putting human beings right to the primacy of concern. Any form of brutal act by anybody should be called out. It's just not right. It's wrong. Now, as I said, I think in South Africa, to a large degree, we have a lot of violence, but that violence is caused by all sorts of structural factors, many of which can be sourced in the violence of apartheid. But in the main, I'm still struck by how we do pretty well on all sorts of levels, and how, you know, we get along with each other often more than we don't, as it were. And I think that's testimony to the best part of human beings.
You you were a judge for many, many years.
Yes.
And you came, I suppose, from a background of representing, as a lawyer, various sides in whatever cases you were involved in. In other words, you had the responsibility of being so invested in the explanation of your client to try and get them off, I suppose, when they were against the law. And then you became a judge where you had to arbitrate, where you had to look at the evidence and then come up with a determination on the basis of the evidence. Was that a hard thing to do? And I suppose I'm asking a very general question for people who were lawyers and then become judges. And I suppose that's the sort of the normal evolution of a judge, that you first have to be a lawyer and then, of course, become a judge. My question is, how is it hard to come from a very, very casuistic place where you've got very clear opinions for a client and then have to evolve into a place where you become an arbiter between two very, very strongly held opinions about a particular case?
It's a great question. I've got to kind of clarify it slightly or qualify it slightly.
Yep.
From my background, because I had an unusual background. I was predominantly an academic lawyer. Most of my early life as a professional was at the University of Cape Town and the University of Witwatersrand. True, I spent quite a bit of time at part-time helping the trade union movement, the nascent FASATU and then KASATU unions, which, of course, I was sort of felt very politically aligned to throughout that period. But I was predominantly an academic lawyer, although I did practice in areas of tax law, labor law, and later constitutional law. And so I didn't have the sort of full-time practice that some of my colleagues had, who would have had in more acute forms the dilemma you talk about. But I have had it to some extent, and I suppose I can answer that as best I can by saying this. I've been struck by the fact over the years in the Labor Appeal Court, where I've sat for many, many years, that my background being also a trade union lawyer and a labor lawyer, and therefore deeply sympathetic to the cause of the unions, finding myself in cases where almost irritated by the union argument because it's been so weak, and being sympathetic to the employer,
yep,
simply on the facts of the case, because you're in a different world. It doesn't mean instinctively. I would think every judge has an instinctive view of a case. In other words, assuming Aubrey's suing somebody else and I am the judge and I read the papers and I say to myself, well, Aubrey must win. I mean, this is outrageous that they haven't paid him his money.
Yeah.
But then the case starts to unfold, and all of a sudden you realize that that initial moral view that you held with it may well be at war with either the legal case that's been before you or the precedent, the legal precedents which confine you. And so you have a kind of almost dialogue with yourself about it. And I think, obviously one would be absolutely absurd to argue that the background of a judge doesn't influence judgments. I mean, that is why we all know that the most important single decision, for example, that the American Supreme Court, American president takes, is who he points to the Supreme Court. And we all know, as is seen by Trump now, he's appointed people who basically share his background. Now, I don't say that that means a judge will automatically decide a case in that way, but there's no doubt our backgrounds influence the way we think about the world and the legal cases which are presented to us.
Is there a specific special kind of training for judges specifically to be able to rise above the, I'm going to call them that, prejudices of our upbringing in order for them to be, I don't know, better equipped to judge? Is there a specific training for judges?
Well, oddly enough, the answer to that, in general terms, is no. Traditionally, we followed the English system, which was that people from the bar became the judges of the courts and of the High Court, certainly. And the argument was that almost as you described it, an advocate from the bar would take cases for both sides. One day he'd be arguing for, let's say, a trade union. The next day he'd be arguing for an employer. One day he'd be arguing for the government. The other day for some non-governmental organization. And the argument was that they had a level of independence which allowed them to be very well equipped to deal with the judicial office. Of course, that wasn't entirely true for a couple of reasons. One is the bar is a particular place. You know, it reproduces its own culture, which is a generally conservative legal culture. And you may remember that for South Africa in particular, when we became a democracy, the vast majority of the senior members of the bar who could have been eligible for judicial appointment were white men. Mm. And clearly diversity was an absolute imperative. So we have drawn from all sorts of ranks within the legal community, from the attorney's profession, the advocate's profession, the academic profession, etc., some people from NGOs to be on the bench. And in the main, you know, it really is a learning experience as you go along. What is normally fantastic about it is the way the older judges, generally, when the system works at its best, the older judges, their doors are always open to give guidance to younger judges as they develop. And you also have a system of acting appointments where lawyers will act on the bench for a term. And if they're guided by the judge president, the head of the court, it is a form of training, but it's a scary form of training because you're on the job and you're actually, you know, and I found when I first started that being quite hair raising because, you know, you're dealing with things you've never dealt with before.
Yeah.
But I was saved to a large degree by a magnificent judge president, Gerald Friedman. He was the head of the court when I started, and the other judges who really, they might not have wanted me there for political reasons, but they didn't want me to fail either. And so the system is, since it helps you. But in answer to your question, no, there is judicial education that takes place throughout the year, but it's not sufficient to say, you know, you've passed the course and now you can be a judge.
I asked that question, Judge, because, as you know, South Africa is at a very, very sensitive stage, has been for the last 30 years, in my opinion, in which we are trying to get a sense of equity, of being centered in some level of fairness. And the 1994 moment that negotiated settlement that gave us the new South Africa, the jury's still out as to its success. In fact, many people are arguing that it hasn't been very successful. And a big part of how that has unfolded is the constitutionalization of the law and the fact that we are trying to move away from the what does my good friend Bratoni call it? From the era of legal positivism, where the law is the law, no context, no contest, no issues or extenuating arguments. That's what the law is, and we're trying to move into a constitutional order. But the argument has been that on both sides of the divide, if there is such a divide, we all have not become constitutional in our thinking. We are still very much on two sides of the same coin of legal positivism. And my question to you is, how have we done, or how has the judiciary done in that space? Because there are a lot of people that are saying that there are very powerful voices that say that the judiciary may not be criticized. I'm not one of those people. I think that the judiciary can be critiqued. But there are those that are arguing that the judiciary should under no circumstances, any circumstances at all, be critiqued. And I'm interested to hear your thoughts about that.
Well, I wonder if I could start with that. You've made a hell of a good point. We could have a whole seminar on what you just said. But let me start at the end and then come back.
Sure.
I personally think the judiciary, of course, should be, you know, of course, we subject to criticism, rightly so. But can I just distinguish between criticism? I think criticism in which judges' performance, which includes, by the way, judges who may not be performing to the best of his or her ability, like delaying of judgments and that sort of stuff, absolutely should be criticized. And I think that the judgments themselves should be debated and criticized. The public are entitled to do that. And I don't think we have enough of that. We don't have enough of that within the media where, you know, the public can read, let's say, significant critiques of judicial performance, which they would understand perfectly, i.e., you know, not the jargon, but stuff that's really important, as you've said. And I don't think the judiciary can be held accountable unless, in fact, there is that sense of public accounting. That does not mean, but there's another part. I do find, and I think most of my colleagues would say this, and I think they're right, is there's a very difference between that and very personal criticisms that we've seen crop up in courts recently, you know, where this is not about the judges choosing a wrong principle, conservative judgment, but really personal vicious attacks. And I have to say, it's an incredibly stressful job. I don't think people understand how stressful this job is.
Yeah.
I'm not a great man for making decisions in my own house. And yet I'm being asked as a judge to decide where children must go to which parent, or whether a law of a country has to be set aside, having been passed by a democratically elected party, whatever it may be. These are very, very onerous tasks. So I think when we decide those cases, we should be held to account. There should be public debate, and the more the better. And if we can keep it at the level of principle, fabulous. In relation to your second point, of course, when we came into the constitutional era, the vast majority of lawyers, I think, were imbued by what you call legal positivism, which essentially, if I can put it in its most simple form, essentially argued that judges are required to apply the law without recourse to a moral set of values.
Yep.
You can say it's a wrong law, but you still have to apply it. And of course, that dominated under apartheid. Once we got into the constitutional era, that became much more difficult, because the nature of a Bill of Rights itself is that it places at the center of a legal system a whole series of moral concerns. Equality, dignity, freedom are now central values within our constitution. And the question, of course, I think, which is implicit in what your observation is, how well have the judiciary done on that? And I would want to say that by and large, the judiciary has done pretty well. Unquestionably, I could say this, that from 1994 onwards, we had the finest sort of judicial performance that South Africa's ever had, by and large, in terms of defending of rights and of individual rights, and of trying to actually increase the repertoire of rights that ordinary citizens hold. Of course, the Constitution hasn't delivered as it should. In other words, I mean, you take a simple example, but I think it illustrates exactly what I'm trying to say. So, for example, in the town that you live in Johannesburg, there wasn't water for goodness sakes how many days.
Yeah.
Yet there's a right to water. Now, that's not the court's fault. That's the political problem. In other words, what I'm trying to say is I think that what has let the show down are less the judiciary and the lack of delivery of promises which are in the Constitution and which people should enjoy and haven't. And that in turn then, in fact, delegitimates the entire operation of the Constitution.
How then would the Constitution have failed South Africans in that situation? Because, as you say, it's not the Constitution that is responsible for the delivering of water or of electricity.
It is judges' responsibility, because we've got social and economic rights, to hold the government to account in this particular regard. It may well be, and I've certainly argued this, that a progressive jurisprudence from the courts would actually demand of the government that when it actually formulates its budget and when it actually makes these decisions, it must, as a priority, ensure that the basic rights which are contained in the Constitution are vindicated, are implemented. And I think that is where judges can play a role. But at the end of the day, the Constitution doesn't only impose obligations upon the judiciary. It imposes obligations on the legislature and the executive.
Sure. Sure.
And when they fail, well, then the whole system fails.
Sure. Suppose that question is connected really to a question that I ask many legal minds when I get the opportunity to speak to them and say, you know, is the law an effective instrument for bringing justice?
We set up a system in which we believe that social change was to be powered by a change in politics, but that the change would take place through a change in the legal system. In other words, the politics would ensure that ultimately the change would be lawful and within and clear and certain, and therefore accord with basic rights, right, basic principles of law. And it is possible, and in fact, I think in South Africa, in many instances, we've closed the gap between, if you wish, law and justice. There are all sorts of cases, particularly, for example, in relation to evictions of people, in relation to gay and lesbian rights, to take a simple example, and in certain instances, with political rights, that the courts have ensured that they can't be taken away from people. And I think that has promoted a more just society than we've ever had in the history of this country.
People who are
imperfect as it is,
sure. People who are landlords would probably disagree, Judge, and say, you know, I can't evict somebody that hasn't paid me my rent for such and such a time until I give them an alternative place to stay. That is bad law, somebody might argue.
Of course they may say it's bad law. I mean, firstly, it's not quite as crude as that, but the truth is the idea of alternative accommodation which by and large as imposed to a large degree on public authorities, it is true that even with private authorities, you can't just evict as such, is precisely because we live in a country in which race and class are intertwined. The vast majority of poor people happen to be black, and we don't want a society in which that occurs. So when you, for example, evict a poor person, you know, are you then saying they just got to live in the felt? And so we wanted to have a society where we actually cared for each other. That didn't mean you couldn't evict the person, but there were certain at least rights that they had as well, so that you were seeking to balance the rights of the property owner against the rights of a vulnerable person. And of course, it's a difficult question. Of course, we don't get it right all the time. But I'd rather live in a society that its primary concern was for the poorest of the poor than for people far more privileged.
Maybe that's not the best of examples, Judge, but here's one that's been living rent-free on my mind.
Yeah.
We've had the unfortunate situation in Gaza, where I think now, 33,000 people have been
yes.
killed. And we applied the law. A crack team of South African legal minds looked at the law, international law, and went to the ICJ and said, we're first going to have a strategy that says we're going to say that what is happening in Gaza is an act of genocide. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, that didn't start off with a immediate call for a ceasefire. It sounded, at least to me, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, it sounded to me like an academic legal argument about the principles of or the what the law says about the classification of an act that could be understood to be genocide. And then only now we're beginning to hear legal minds pushing more for a ceasefire. The law was applied, but it seemed not to bring the outcome, which was the most desired and most important outcome for the people in Gaza, was a ceasefire. That's why I'm asking the question that says, when we approach the issue of justice from a legal point of view, and don't ask me what other option do you have, Aubrey, because I don't know what other option there is. But I sometimes feel like the legal approach is very cerebral and intellectual and, quite frankly, pedestrian, and doesn't provide the needed outcome.
Aubrey, let me, I'm going to answer your question directly, but I'm going to start in an indirect fashion. You are quite right. Law doesn't on its own requires politics. On its own, it's not going to change the world, but it changes conditions in which politics can operate. And we've got living examples of that in South African history. So if you go back to the 1980s, and I mentioned the trade union movement, the COSATU, you know, how did they grow to be an organization which at the end of, by the end of apartheid, people had, as it were, labor citizenship without political citizenship, meaning they had rights to strike. They couldn't, they had the unfair labor practice on their side. They could organize. And by goodness, they organized extremely. I mean, they could close down the government, and they did in a way that oddly enough, unions can't do today because they're not as organized. And the way that that worked, is they used the law to gain rights. Rights, for example, to access to factories. Rights, for example, to consult their members. Rights, for example, to say you couldn't dismiss somebody without cause. And all of those rights, they then used those rights for, to continue their political programs, to expand their political power. But the rights helped them do that. It was also true of the way the Treatment Action Campaign used law and politics to ensure that we got antiretrovirals for people living with AIDS. And so if you ask me what happened in Gaza, I don't think the South African legal team, many of whom, in fact, not many of whom, all of whom, in a sense, come from the same human rights tradition that I do, including one of my own mentors, Professor John Dugard, whom I'm very proud to say I succeeded as the director of the Center for Applied Legal Studies, WITS, many, many years ago. All of them came from that background. They would have known perfectly that whatever the court would do, it was highly unlikely that Israel was going to simply say, oh, sure, now we'll abide by that 100%. But I think it changed the politics. I think it sort of focused attention on the fact that there was something going on here which was not legally correct, and essentially made life much more difficult for those who might well have been defending Israeli action compared to what happened before. I also think that when you ask me about the ceasefire, the court legally, and this is where the limitations of law do come in, I agree with you. The court, I think, didn't want to get into the ceasefire argument because Hamas were not a national government and therefore were not party to the Genocide Convention, and therefore were not susceptible to the jurisdiction of the court. So it's very difficult for them to say, we'll have a ceasefire which requires both parties, when in fact it was only talking to one. But I don't think you should underestimate the effect, political effect, that a legal victory of that kind had. Has it stopped the situation? Sadly not. You know, was it implemented? No. But I think it changed the way people thought about the conflict and continuously does so. So I, what I'm trying to say to you is law is a limited vehicle. It's not a panacea. Yeah. It will not solve all our problems in the world, but it helps. And I that's why I used the examples of the Treatment Action Campaign and the unions in the 80s. Law actually can help if you've got a politics that can exploit the law to push for greater forms of justice.
You talk of politics. We are in a situation at the moment where South Africa is looking again to be centered to, as some people have said, to press the reset button so that we can have a sense of the rule of law at the highest levels of governance. People are under question for having broken the law in various ways. People who have great amounts of power, people who are considered perhaps to have enough power to sway the minds and the lips of the judiciary. And we have seen very recently a situation where a very senior politician, in fact, the third most powerful politician, is facing some serious allegations of graft. And it's been the big conversation of the week. And there's a very, very strong sense that says in South Africa that says, yeah, all of this is the theatrics of politics, even using the judiciary. Can South Africans genuinely believe that there is a real fight for the rule of law here? Or are we in yet another theatrical production of the feigning of the fight for the rule of law by people who have very, very unlimited power?
I think we're in a fight for the rule of law and for democracy, which is essentially underpinned by law all over the world. It's not just South Africa. Have a look at countries that once were liberal democracies, like Hungary, which now has Orbán, or America, which faces the prospect of Donald Trump and moving into a quasi-fascist form of government. And I don't exaggerate that. I mean, that's commentators in America talking about that all the time. Or many, many other countries in which the idea of a constitutional society doesn't seem any longer to be quite as attractive as it was. Now, in South Africa, I still think that the vast majority of people, and I might be wrong, and I mean, there's a lot of evidence which goes both ways, still probably think that this is our best shot at developing a society which will provide dignity, freedom, and equality for all 60 million. But I do agree with, I think implicit in your question is, there's a fight for this. It's not a foregone conclusion. And you don't emerge from 300 years of racist authoritarian rule into a constitutional democracy, just like with a blink of an eye. You have to fight for these rights, and you have ups and you have downs. But I do think that in a sense, what this election is about, to a large degree, and what people will need to consider is which parties, which are up for this election, are really there to sincerely promote a constitutional democracy where every South African will.
And how do we determine that? How we as citizens determine that?
You have to look what their manifestos are, look at their background, look what they've done until now. I mean, you know, none of them are perfect. I accept that, and I'm not going to go into the party politics of it.
Sure.
But surely that's the first question. If you believe, as I do, that this still gives us our best bet, then I'd rather live in a society where you and I can have a massive agreement, disagreement, let's say on the radio, and both of us can shake hands and have a beer afterwards, and we won't have any legal consequences attached to what the differences are, because we've got freedom of speech.
Sure.
I do not want to live in a society where all of a sudden, as you see in parts of America, where certain books are no longer available at schools and where certain forms of speech are then closed down, and that we can't actually have a society where people are free to talk their own minds. In a sense, that's what I heard you talking about before I came on, which was we can differ with each other, but we should be able to talk to each other.
Sure.
So I'm absolutely passionate about the fact that a constitutional democracy is the best bet, but it has to be one. It has to be one which essentially also is going to deliver. You can't have political democracy and economic poverty and inequality of the kind we're having in any long-term way. So when you ask yourself which are the parties that are desperately committed, best committed to that project, you have to ask yourself, well, what is their track record being about rights? It doesn't mean using rights for their own advantage. Yep. It doesn't mean the kind of concept of lawfare, which is you use rights expediently to show up your opponents, but you really aren't committed to them. And if you get into power, God help us, what happens? But it does ask, you have to ask the question, who are constitutionalists in this world? And secondly, are they committed to ensuring that the constitution works both politically and economically for the entire population of this country? That's what we set out to do in 1994. And, you know, you ask me how you do that. Well, everybody's going to have to decide for themselves and listen carefully to, you know, and when you, people like yourself interview the various politicians, to ask them those questions and to probe them. Some of them don't like being probed.
No, they don't. Let me probe you then.
And by the way, those are the ones that I think we've got to say, well, thank you very much. And you can't possibly have my vote because you should be susceptible to, say, Aubrey Masangu asking a series of questions to the person and for them to defend themselves so that the voter can actually judge for himself or herself.
Sure. Are we a society that is constitutionally minded? In other words, my question assumes that in order for a constitutional order to be successful, the people who are the constituents of that country must themselves have bought into the idea of constitutionalism. Now, we're a strange country. We have monarchs. We have we have monarchs. We have deeply traditional conservative ways of thinking about the world. We have, and that is the vast majority of South Africans. We're deeply religious and conservative and all of those kinds of things. Does the constitutional order envisaged by the Bill of Rights, the Constitution, fit the reality of the minds of the people of this country?
But didn't we fight for that? Wasn't that what it was all about?
Well, I don't know if I agree. Let me put it to you this way, Judge Davis.
Sure.
There was a big argument on this show about whether we were fighting for democracy or for freedom. And if you listen to the rhetoric of the struggle prior to 1994, it was a fight for freedom. And at some point, it became a fight for democracy. And so the question then becomes, was democracy in its constitutional form what we were fighting for? Because it seems to me sometimes it just seems to me that there is a mismatch between the ideals of a liberal, democratic, constitutional environment and the mindsets of a generally conservative, traditional population.
You're quite right. But let me put this to you. From 1955 and the Freedom Charter, most South Africans walked under the banner that South Africa belonged to all who lived here, that we were all part of this, and we wanted our freedom, but when you have a society where it belongs to all who live in it, and you look at the rest of that program of the Freedom Charter, was, in a sense, to have a democratic order where every single person would be treated equally with fundamental rights. That's what it was all about. The two inextricably linked. It is absolutely correct that what has happened is that the failure to deliver on our economic promises to the vast majority of the population get more and more people thinking we'd rather have an authoritarian leader who can deliver economic goods to us than some form of liberal or in my case social democratic constitutional order where delivery doesn't take place. And so yes, there will always be threats if you can't actually show the vast majority of the population that both of these can work for you. Do I think at this point in time that most South Africans still would prefer to have a democratic order? Yeah, I do. I think, you know, we may not get the full amount of people voting, but we'll get over significantly over 50% will go to the polls to exercise their democratic choice.
Judge Davis, what do you do to relax?
I have a lot of things I do to relax. What I do to relax that doesn't relax me is I'm a fanatical Manchester United supporter. So that meant that last night was a terrible night for me. I couldn't relax as a result of that because we lost 4-3 in the last minute. I'm a great lover of film and music, and reading, and of course cricket and rugby apart from football. So I have very lots of things that I relax in, to the point that makes my life much richer. Thank you.
What is the one book that you would want all South Africans to read?
Well, that's an interesting question. I tell you the book I would like all the politicians to read is a book by which I read recently, which is the book written by Martin Wolf, the chief economist at the Financial Times. It's a book in which he basically states out a case for a new democratic order, and in which what he's arguing for is essentially a kind of a new deal, but for the 21st century, not the Rooseveltian 1930s one. Yes. If I could give every politician a copy of his book and say, please read this, because I think it really reflects to a large degree what we should be trying to do in South Africa, I'd be a happy man.
Judge Dennis Davis, it's been a privilege and an honor to talk to you. Thank you very much for agreeing to talk to us.
Thank you so much.